My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dana Stabenow. I'm saying your name right, is that?
Stabenow.
Stabenow. There you
Nobody ever gets it right. Don't worry about it, Ed.
Well, yeah, but really, I mean, that's like the least courtesy you can possibly afford someone. So the title of your latest book is A Night Too Dark, and it's published by Minotaur Press, and it's one of your Kate Shugak books. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about Kate.
Kate and I were both born in Alaska. She's a little younger than I am. Let's not say how much. This is the 17th novel in this series, and it's the first novel after the discovery of a world-class gold mine in her backyard, which is a generic national park, which takes up about a third of the state of Alaska.
I discovered in reading your books that we are the outside.
You are, with a capital O.
With
it's a
capital
proper
O,
noun.
Yeah. Yes. I always thought Lower 48 covered it, but that's not even
There's
close.
That too. Actually, if you go back and you read the newspapers from the time of the Klondike Gold Rush, you were called outside then.
Okay.
We used to blue ticket evildoers outside.
Blue ticket?
Blue ticket, yes. We'd give them a blue colored ticket, on a one-way ticket on a steamer going south.
Oy. I have read just a few of your books, and it's not because I haven't wanted to read them. It's because I haven't had the opportunity reading. I have to read books from who's ever coming through town. But I've always admired your work,
Thank you.
You have more than one series. Tell us about your other series.
Well, the other series is out of print, but it was the Liam Campbell series, which is a story of a state trooper that was set in a fictional town based on Dillingham, which is in southwest Alaska. And he's a trooper that has to fly to every crime scene, and he's terrified of flying. One of the many things that I did.
Why do we like to freight down our protagonists with as much weight as possible, with problems and mental, you know, quirks? And what's the story there?
It makes them that much more human. Don't we all have plenty of quirks?
No, no, speak for yourself. I'm perfect here.
you're quirk clear?
I was going to ask you, and you mentioned that you were born in Alaska. I was going to ask you how long you had been there, but apparently the answer is your whole life.
Well, I was born in the territory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny, you know, that there's been a controversy lately about whether Obama was born in the United States, or even if he was born in Hawaii, how exotic Hawaii is. And it occurs to me that Hawaii doesn't even touch Alaska for exotic. Am I mistaken in that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, Hawaii is the only state that ever had a king. Alaska never had a king.
That's true. there was a baron in Arizona, but that's as close as we come. The reason I ask that is that in reading this book, and again, the title of the book is A Night Too Dark, I noticed that there's politics of six or seven different varieties at any given situation. There's tribal politics. There's interpersonal politics. There's politics as we know it. And then there's the politics of us versus them, and us versus them can be plugged into several different oppositions. Mm-hmm. Am I incorrect?
Oh, yeah. Us versus them usually is Alaskans versus everybody else.
Yeah.
Especially with the old farts.
Now, has Alaska been subject to more scrutiny since a certain governor just resigned?
You put it mildly, sir. Yes, it's like having a 10 gazillion gigawatt spotlight focused on us all the time. There's no getting away. You can't turn around anymore without looking at the New York Times and seeing a story about Alaska. The census started in Alaska, so that was deserving of a front page story. Please don't ask me about the details, but there are some shenanigans to do with the retirement program of the state. And
That's in the Times this morning.
It was just in there a couple of weeks ago. I mean, we can't turn around. I mean, now that people are aware that we exist, and so many reporters, I think, came up to Alaska during her tenure and her run for vice president, that now it's like, oh, there's like really interesting people up there, and there are really interesting stories, and look what's going on there. Yeah, we never had that before.
Didn't we always know that? I mean, you know, I used to be a great fan of Robert W. Service, and that just told me that the Yukon Territory in Alaska was terra incognita to me, a Jewish
you
kid
are
from
among,
New York.
You are among the few. You are few and far between.
The Creation of Sam McGee is one of my favorite poems of all time.
But one of everybody's, one of, yes.
That's good.
We can recite it with you.
or To Build a Fire, the Jack London story.
I think that's required reading for every Alaska high school student, To Build a Fire. They certainly made me read it.
That's the most horrifying thing I've ever read in my life.
All he wants to do is get warm.
Yeah,
and he kills himself.
That's right.
Yes.
By accident. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, we just gave away the whole story. I'm sorry. let me talk about some of the characters. This is Kate Shugak, and she is the star, the protagonist, the main character of this series. She has a boyfriend named Jim. Is it Chopin, like the composer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he's a state trooper.
Yes,
but she's a PI. What exactly is her job?
She used to be an investigator for the Anchorage DA, and she burned out after 5.5 years of investigating sex crimes in Anchorage, and came home wounded both in body and in spirit. And about 18 months later, was recruited to work independently, freelance, I guess is the right word, for pretty much anybody who'd who could write the check. And I think it was along about the, I think it's the seventh book, Breakup, that she's trying to figure out what to call herself in the IRS on her tax return and decides, okay, she is a private detective.
That's good. I like that. Tell us what a park rat is.
Oh, a park rat. Somebody is a park rat who lives in Kate lives in this generic national park, and I didn't want to name the park. It's loosely based on the Wrangell-St. Elias Mountains. But I didn't want to name it because then I couldn't change the borders whenever I wanted to, which I do like to do from time to time. And anyone who lives in the park is essentially a park rat.
Okay. And these are insiders, even on to insiders. I mean, the other Alaskans are outsiders.
Everybody else, it's almost like Maine, you know. Everybody else is from away.
Yeah. There's gold in them, Thar Hills.
Oh, my, yes.
Which is almost the main reason that Alaska exists even today, that people went there. Furs and gold.
We know how to get stuff out of the ground and the water. And that's essentially our raison d'etre, yes. And so it is in the book. Naturally, the gold mine in Kate's Park is based on the real Pebble gold mine, which I can almost see from my doorstep.
When you're not looking at Russia?
Yeah, when I'm not looking. Well, Russia's a little further on.
Okay.
I just thought it would be interesting to. I always like to confront Kate with real life stuff, you know, stuff to rip right out of the headlines. So I picked up the Pebble Mine and I put it down in Kate's Park, and it's going to occupy a great. It's going to burn up a lot of the oxygen in Kate's air for the next, I'd say, few books.
Now, you know James Lee Burke, I'm sure.
I haven't met him, but I know who he is.
He's a wonderful man, and originally from Louisiana. I think he lives in Montana or Wyoming now. But I interviewed him once for a book about the despoilation of Louisiana by the oil companies and the chemical companies. Mm-hmm. And he was really PO'd. I mean, I think environmentalist is not the right word. He just hates to see a place that he loves screwed over so badly. Do I detect some of that in this book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've often thought, you know, why can't they just let a beautiful place be? But $1,000 an ounce, they're not going to.
Yeah, that's right.
Somebody's going to get it out of the ground.
They'll be picking the gold out of people's teeth before long.
No, it's not just the gold. It's the oil. It's the fish. It's, you know, every natural resource that we have. Natural resources are what made Alaska what it is today. And it will always and ever be that way until somebody figures out something else to do with the people there.
I always tell young people, if somebody defines you as our most precious natural resource, just look what they've done to our other precious natural resources.
Well, that's a really cheery thought, Ed. Thanks.
Well, I'm here to help. I'm going to have a problem with first of all, let me try to say Nilnitna. Is that how you say it?
Nilnitna.
Yeah, and tell us what that is.
It's the town. It's Kate's hometown. Well, village, really. I mean, there's only a couple hundred people in it. But it's the largest village in the park. And it's basically where all Kate's relatives live. She lives about 50 miles away.
Mm-hmm. There was a mine there called the Sulutak mine?
The original copper mine that the town was pretty much founded on was the Kanuyak, but that went out of business in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
The new mine, Sulutak, is an Aleut word for gold, and that's the mine that they have just discovered here in the past 2 Kate years.
2 Kate years. And there's, which could be like 9 or 10 years in real
time. Oh, it could be
any,
yes.
Yeah. Golden Harvest is the company that's extracting, or they're actually the discovery company.
They're the discovery company,
yes.
But they have, I believe, I can't remember now. You're asking, I've written the next book in the series. I can't remember what happened in this one.
How quickly we forget.
I think that they've joined up with an international natural resource extraction company now. So they're all set to, they're still defining the limits of the field, and they're doing their EIS statement. There's only about 100 employees there. Eventually, they project that there will be 3,000 during construction, and then 2,000 over a period of 20 years, regular employees.
Let me ask you a big question, and I know you're going to have an answer for this, so I'm not worried that I'm sandbagging you or anything.
Pressure's on.
Yeah, pressure's on. people like me, and I think people like you, we try to hold two conflicting thoughts in our head at the same time. One is that we hate to see our beautiful land despoiled just for the extraction of resources. And the other thing is we wish our neighbors had jobs.
We definitely wish our neighbors had jobs.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, and I don't have any easy answer for you. I was born and raised in Alaska. I've lived there all my life. I've seen the villages die. You know, these are artificial constructs, these villages. A lot of the native people in Alaska were hunter-gatherer tribes. They were following the caribou up into the mountains and the fish into the streams. And then we came along with our notions of private property and said, okay, you have to settle on one place, so most of them settled in fish camps and where the food was. And we built them schools. We've, you know, built them all kinds of stuff, but there's no industry there. There's no jobs for them. I mean, jobs are like the real gold in the Alaskan bush. So a lot of these villages are dying, and they're moving into the bigger towns, the regional areas like, you know, Bethel and Kotzebue and Nome and Barrow and Dillingham. And a lot of them are moving to Anchorage, which is the, you know, state's largest town, because, you know, what we call Anchorage is Alaska's largest native village. It's mm-hmm. true.
And also has some of the best weather in the state, too.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Doesn't
I have to think about that. Yeah, right. You're just saying that what you're fixating on is it's more south than a lot of the places there. But to answer your question, you know, yeah, there's a real problem between having jobs in the villages, but at the same time, you know, you want it to still be the most beautiful place in the world, which of course we all think it is. And, you know, to leave it alone, to let a beautiful place be. What's the balance there? What do you do? I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I don't want people to move out. I want the kids to, you know, have better jobs than just making beds and waiting tables, you know, for the tourists, that's a very good job to have while you're going to school. But maybe that's not something you want your kids to do for the rest of their lives. And, you know, it'd be great if they had a job that paid a decent wage that, you know, they could stay home and work.
Yeah. You know, there's a H.L. Mencken said that for every difficult problem, there's an answer which is both simple and wrong. And it occurs to me that this situation is going to give us a lot of simple, wrong answers.
So. It's the Pebble Mine in Alaska right now, the mine on which my fictional mine is based on, is the single most, I'd say, it's the biggest issue we're fighting over right now. There are people, these guys haven't even done the environmental impact statement yet. It takes 2 years to do an EIS. Well, part of the reason is they haven't defined the limits of the mine. They can't figure out, they keep drilling core samples, and there was just a story here recently, and they said they still haven't found the limits of the mine. Mm-hmm. It started out being the world's second largest gold mine, and it's looking like it's going to be the world's largest gold mine ever. And so, they don't even know. They don't even know yet. And then everybody was all up in arms because they thought it was going to be an open pit mine. Well, they found an even larger deposit right next to it that is a below ground mine that they can now go in after with a lot less danger to the environment. You know, I mean, who knows what's going to happen here? But there is the possibility for serious local industry and serious jobs. And how do you balance that with, you know, maintaining the quality of the environment? I don't know. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah, especially since gold mining is not the most environmentally friendly form of mining.
Well, open pit mining is definitely not the
Yeah. I know that they're still defining the limits of the mine, but can you give us an idea approximately of how big it is already?
Oh, God. I've got the figures. They're actually, I've used sort of real-time estimates in the book. So, you know, I can't pull them out of my... You should have contacted me earlier. I'd have the facts and figures for you.
Had I but not.
And you know what? I'd give you the answer, and there'd probably be a story in the Anchorage Daily News tomorrow, and I'd be all wrong because they just, you know, drilled some more core samples.
Well, we promise not to check up on you anymore.
Oh, yeah, you will.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Dana Stabenow, and her last name is spelled Stabenow. The title of the book is A Night Too Dark, published by Minotaur. As I started reading this book, I kept waiting for the plot to kick in. There was a lot of stuff about tribal politics, a lot of stuff about the politics of the town, a lot of stuff about interpersonal relationships that that Kate has with people like old Sam. And I'm saying, gee whiz, when the hell is the plot going to kick in? And then when it kicked in, it went into overdrive immediately. The last half of this book, it just runs like a rocket through to the conclusion. Do you generally pace books like that?
Not always, no. I was trying something different here. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't.
It worked for me.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad you stuck around.
Oh, yes.
I did it that way deliberately. You can't write the same way. You can't write to the same formula every time. Otherwise, you're going to be bored, and I guarantee you the reader is going to be bored as well. So I do try to try different things.
You know, that's right away, I like you for that, because there are any number of writers out there who think what you just said is nonsense, and they just write 127 books all the same with different titles.
Well, I'm not reading those 100. I'm not reading probably past 9.
Yeah, okay. So good for you. How many Alaskas are there? You know, we think of Alaska, you know, but really, as I was reading your book, I see there's more than one Alaska. There's a do you know what I'm talking about?
I am. I'm laughing because it's a good question. It really is. I hate it when people say that, but it is a good question. Damn it! People in Alaska would say there's Anchorage and there's everywhere else. I think I could say that without fear of contradiction. But of course, you're right. I mean, you go to Dillingham and they what do they call it? Disneyham. They call them, that's what they call their town, Disneyham. And if you go out to Bethel, there's a totally different, for one thing, there's way more Yupik in Bethel. It's almost it's way a majority Yupik town. And then you go to Nome and you've got a lot of Inupiaq in the mix. And then you go up to Barrow and, you know, they're all different. They're all different. You go to Fairbanks, lots of Gwich'in, and Athabascans. A lot of these places are defined by the Alaska natives there, but they're also defined by their topography. The interior people are going to be a lot different than the coastal people, and the southern coastal people are going to be a lot different than the northern coastal people. One of the reasons that Aleuts have such an incredible culture and some of the most incredible art you will ever see in your life is because they had such a rich food source. It wasn't easy for them to make a living, but it was easier for them to make a living, so they had a little more leisure time to where they could perfect things like ivory carving. If you ever want to see an example of early, effective, efficient technology, take a look at an Aleut visor. They are really astonishing.
You mean the little slats across
the
ice?
No, those are the snow. Those are the snow goggles. Okay. Those are more Inupiaq, I think.
Okay.
I hope Yupik doesn't hear me and slap me down.
So we're not going to check up on the
goggles. There's probably a Yupik and Inupiaq listening out there
right now. Yeah.
The visor is this. It can be a bentwood visor that is sort of steamed and formed in this sort of shape. It's really difficult to describe. You have to see it.
Like an
eagle beak. Yeah. Or a raven beak, probably,
yeah.
Even. And it extends out. They would wear it when they're out in the kayaks looking, you know, hunting for sea lions, sea otters, anything. Food, essentially, seals. And they had, there was a sight. They had built a sight into the bottom part so that they could focus on throwing the harpoon straight and hitting their target. They had, I think it was walrus whiskers fixed to the outside so they could tell which way the wind was blowing so they could correct for drift when they're throwing the harpoon. I mean, it's just the most astonishing thing. The old folks knew what they were doing. There's a reason that they ate really well.
Mm-hmm. Back when I was an anthropology student, I wrote a paper on thinking that pre-literate tribes are in some way unsophisticated because they developed some of the most sophisticated weapons in the history of the world and systems for using them.
Well, they just because they didn't know how to read and write didn't mean they weren't smart as a whip.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they read and write different things than we do. Oil versus gold. Is there an oil versus gold thing going on? And it's part of the plot of the book. I don't want to give too much away, but are people saying we want to drill for oil here, and somebody else saying no, we want gold or copper or whatever the hell's going on here? I mean, they're literally fighting over how to ruin the land.
You know, that's another good question. I would say they're more comfortable with oil because mm-hmm. oil's already there and it's proven effective. I mean, Exxon Valdez notwithstanding, the Trans-Alaska pipeline, I worked in Prudhoe Bay for 6 years, and we just had a major earthquake up there, a couple of years ago in the Denali Fault, which is the central fault that runs through the center of Alaska. And it was quite a jolter. I can't remember the exact, thing on the Richter scale. It went off with a hell of a bang, and people were really nervous and went and checked out the all 800 miles of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It had been so well engineered and so well built. It didn't drop an oil. There was not a single, all the VSMs works, all the place where it was buried, you know, stayed buried and didn't break. It just, I mean, it was a really good job. It was really well done. So people are comfortable now. You know, they feel a little more secure. We can pull all the oil out of the ground we want fairly safely. We're going to have to keep an eye on them in Valdez for sure. But, and then you come along with gold, and you have this huge, enormous gold, and you have to deal with an open pit mine. I don't know what the zinc mine, what the Red Dog mine north of Nome is. I don't know. I think it's an open pit mine. I'm not sure, though. I'd have to check on that. But that seems to have been fairly safe and effective. Nevertheless, nobody really hears about it, so I don't know necessarily if there is a gold or oil dichotomy going on.
You may have noticed that I'm dancing around asking you about the plot of the book, and there's a reason for that. The reason is I don't want to give anything away. And anything, any book that's as plot-driven as this gives me some pause about dancing too heavily on the plot. So why don't I let you tell us what you want to tell us about what Kate is trying to find. I can say this, right? They find a pickup truck, and the guy's left a note in a pickup truck saying, "I've had it. I'm walking into the woods to be devoured by the first thing that comes along." Mm. Take it from there.
Well, actually, that was taken from a story I read, an interview with a park ranger. It wasn't even in Alaska. And evidently, there is this thing where people who want to end it all will just drive into the nearest national park and start walking and figure that they will never be found again. And they're mostly right about that. So in this book, it's partly some of the bills for the mine starting to come due. The bills in Kate's backyard, you know, how this is going to affect the people who live in the park, the park rats. And partly it is just an old-fashioned whodunit.
And a why done it.
And also a mis. I love the misidentification. We probably better not say any more about that.
Mm-hmm. The four aunties.
Oh, I love the aunties.
Yes, I know you do. This is part of the peculiar personal politics, the tribal mm-hmm. politics, really, of mm-hmm. Alaska. Tell us about the four aunties and what their function is in the town.
The four aunties have, since Kate's grandmother died, they have stepped up, and they are essentially the moral center of the park. And one of the things, it's interesting that you zeroed in on that, because their lives are changing in a major way. There's four different scenes with these aunties, and their lives are changing in a major way because of the
influx of money?
The influx of money, but also the opportunities that have been afforded them by the appearance of all these young men with money and this, you know, enormous corporation with all the money in the world to spend. And like I say, some of the bills are coming due now. And these are the early bills, and the later bills are going to probably be even harder to pay.
Is their position in the town a reflection of the way their tribe organizes itself?
I mean, absolutely. I was talking to this was quite some time ago. I was talking to a group of people at the university, or Alaska Pacific University. It's one of the two universities in Anchorage, and it was a class on the crime fiction and sociology. I think the sociology teacher just, you know, wanted to read crime fiction, and she was trying to figure out a way. Anyway, there were 36 people in that class. There was one guy, and there was one young girl named Stephanie from a town called Neustoya, which is a village that's it's one of those artificial villages that they've had to move it three times because the riverbank keeps crumbling from underneath them. And she was Yupik. And, you know, in that culture, when you're raised in that culture, in particular, if you're a woman, they're quiet anyway as a cultural rule. But if you're a woman, you never speak up. You don't talk. So here she is. She's in Anchorage. She's not in her village anymore. She's in Anchorage. There's, you know, a man there, and there's a whole bunch of older women, and everybody's white except for her. And so I was talking about the book, whatever book it was at that time. And, you know, I wanted her to talk so bad. I wanted her to say something, anything to be included. I just, you know, I tried not to stare at her because, you know, you don't do that. Culturally, it's unacceptable to make eye contact, you know. And finally, she put up this little trembling hand and she said, "I love Kate," she said, "because Kate speaks up." And then that kind of broke the dam. And later on, I can't remember which book it was, but there was some kind of tribal response to an event that had happened, and the aunties came down very hard on, you know, what was or was not the right thing to do. So I tossed it to Stephanie, and I said, is it like that in the villages, knowing that she, if she was going to tell the truth, that she was, and she said, oh, yeah, that there was a tribal council, she said, and if you misbehave, you were hauled up in front of them. And I said, and how awful is that? And she blushed, and she squirmed, and she said, oh, she said, it's just the most terrible, horrible thing. You don't ever want that to happen. Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish we could run our society like that. That's when you think about all you need is the cocking of an eyebrow to get somebody to behave correctly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really amazing. One of the other things I like is that all your characters, well, not all, but a lot of your characters have portmanteau names, you know, a Swedish first name with a Yupik last name, or a Russian first name or a Russian last name.
There are almost no purebloods left in Alaska. You know, they're by far and away in the minority of the population. Everybody is intermarried. You know, the gold miners came up, and a lot of them stayed intermarried with the local tribes. There's a ton of Norwegians, Swedish, Finnish, Danes along the south, coastally. I think probably fully a quarter of the native population of Alaska has some African American blood, because Roran Mike Healy, who was revenue cutter captain, very famous in the area, evidently scattered his seed far and wide in Alaska. So yeah, it is a polyglot society.
I was amazed at how many Russian names, you know, you think the Russians have been there, well, you know, since 1859, but that's
in the town I grew up in. What was his name? Peterson. I mean that's not a very Russian name.
No,
but he was
yeah.
Yeah, but he was from Mikhail Baryshnikov, Ukraine. He was Ukrainian, and I don't know how he wound up with a name like Peterson. He was an old guy when I knew him growing up in Soldovia, and he walked across when the Russian Revolution happened. He was a young man. He didn't want to get involved in any of it. He walked across Russia to Vladivostok and took ship for Alaska. And that's how he wound up in Soldovia, Alaska. And I met him when I was a kid.
That's interesting, because the Scandinavians are seafaring people anyway. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, they all came on whaling ships.
Yeah.
And some of them stayed.
And loggers. Mm-hmm. So what are you working on now?
This is something completely new and different. I'm writing a novel about Marco Polo's granddaughter traveling the Silk Road west from China to England in the years between 1322 and 1327.
Is this based on an actual person? Or
no.
Is this clearly?
No,
out
I read.
Of your,
this
out
is
your...
based on me reading the travels of Marco Polo and never being able to get over it. And he was in China for 20 years, and you can't tell me the guy didn't scatter some seed around himself.
Oh, that was
he
what
liked
they
the
did.
Ladies too.
Yeah.
If you read the Marco Polo's travels, you'll notice that he did like the ladies a lot.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of Westerners are called ghost people and long noses. They're not considered particularly attractive by some of the Chinese.
Round eyes. Well, yeah. One of the reasons that she leaves is because at that time China was very xenophobic. It was just prior to them slamming the shutters and locking the door and turning everybody away, which they did for centuries, literally.
They don't call themselves a central kingdom for
that's
reason.
Right. Everything under the heavens is something they call Chengdu at that time. Yeah. And so in reaction to that, my character is going to be, you know, leaving for a better life elsewhere, among other reasons. There's an evil stepmother that figures into the narrative.
We haven't seen that in a while, since Snow White, I think.
There's a reason that the trophies work.
So when can we expect to see this book, do you think?
Well, I don't know, because I'm writing it totally on spec. I wrote the next Kate Shugak novel very fast last year, partly for that, and partly because it grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and wouldn't let go, and so that I could have this year, I could pay my rent this year while I worked on this book. Because it's time, I've been threatening to write it for, 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's time to fish or cut bait.
I agree. Like you care what
okay,
I think.
Okay,
Ed. Yeah. I just want to see more of your books, and I promise to read more of them if you promise to come back and talk to us.
Anytime.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming. Dana Stabenow, STABENOW, A Night Too Dark, published by Minotaur. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Ed.